The hour of 12:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee members. We had left off with the Office of Higher Ed. I'm on page 29 of the Minnesota State Grant, March 4th, 2013. And if folks would reintroduce themselves for the record, please.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I'm a policy analyst with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education.
Welcome to the committee, and where are we starting today?
You were right. It is slide 29. As soon as I can get PowerPoint to work.
Well.
Slide 29 is where we left off on Wednesday, and it essentially is the two affordability considerations that the Office of Higher Education struggles with on an annual basis. It is essentially the fact that the state grant designed for shared responsibility requires that we assess families based on their assets and income. It also requires that we assess students based on future benefits that they are likely to receive from their post-secondary education. As a result, we must essentially judge whether those assessments are reasonable, and we believe that because we use the results of federal policy to determine the family contribution, that those assessments may be unreasonable for some families. In addition, we know that the state grant is not, it's not a panacea in that it can solve all of our financial problems where it comes to higher education. It is simply one tool that you have before you in order to ensure that we can provide a more affordable access to higher education. Almost there. Okay. So now if we move on to slide 30, this is actual data from the IPEDS, or the U.S. Department of Education Integrated Post-Secondary Survey Education Data Series. And it essentially shows for Minnesota colleges by income level of the students how much we expect students and families to pay out of pocket. So those costs that remain after all grants are accounted for, state grants, Pell grants, as well as institutional aid. You can see that the public institutions do have the lowest net price among all income categories for students in Minnesota, with the lowest income students, those in the $0 to $30,000 category, having much lower net prices than those, of course, at $110,000 or above.
Go ahead, proceed. I don't see anyone with a question. I assume you're doing very well, and it's all being comprehended.
Great. The next set of slides we have is just a kind of an overview on where we spent state grant funds last year, to which students were those funds awarded. So the first chart we always like to show is the number of recipients, state grant recipients by income category. Those students at the lowest incomes are by far the number one recipients of state grants. 25% of state grant recipients have family incomes of less than $10,000. Approximately 59% of state grant recipients have incomes less than $30,000. This is very concentrated among lowest income families. In terms of spending, the next slide on slide 33 shows Pell Grant and state grant awards, total spending by those income categories. As you can see, Pell Grants by far are targeted towards the lowest income group. Approximately $94 million went to those students who had incomes less than $10,000. Pell Grant declines as students move up the income scale, and this is where you see that the Minnesota State Grant is a complement to the federal Pell Grant, in that we provide a supplement at each of those income levels to reach the level of kind of grant aid that we deem under the program. In terms of average grants per student, you can see that at the lowest income category on slide 34, students from families who are in less than $10,000 receive a combined grant of approximately $5,030 last year. And this is a combination of Pell Grant plus state grants. The federal Pell Grant maximum is $5,550, but not all of these students are full-time. This does include a substantial number of part-time students in these income categories. You can see that the combined grant award is fairly stable through the $40,000 range, and then we slowly taper out as we move up the income scale. In terms of distribution of state grants by students, we classify them according to the institution in which they enroll. You can see here that we have a split for MNSCU 2 years, MNSCU 4 years, University of Minnesota, as well as private nonprofit and private for-profit. In terms of state grant funds, Minnesota two-year colleges have 43% of recipients and receive approximately 17% of state grant funds. And this is the fact that the state grant takes into account the tuition and fees charged to that student when calculating a state grant. So you are going to see students at two-year institutions receive a lower share of state grant funds as compared to recipients. You can also see this at the MNSCU 4 years, you see approximately 16% of recipients and 18% of funds. University of Minnesota, 12% of recipients, 25% of funds. They would be at the top of that tuition and fees charge scale. Private nonprofits, a similar pattern to the U of M. And private for-profits have approximately 14% of recipients and 11% of funds. So I see my chart has all zeros on one side.
I noticed that too. Is that, want to explain that?
Yeah, I think that's a typo.
I was wondering why they zeroed out.
With all the times we read through this, you think I would have been, that would have been circled. The numbers should be,
the blame always goes to the top, so the director is really at
excellent.
Fault.
A little skills gap in cut and paste maybe for the staff as well. Total dollars to the University of Minnesota in terms of, well, in terms of state grant is $35.8 million. In terms of private nonprofits, it's $41.2 million, and private for-profits, $15.8. The total should be $142.73. We'll fix this and redistribute it. In terms of recipients, University of Minnesota had just over 11,300. Private nonprofits, 13,790, and for-profits, 13,418. We'll fix it. This is the slide 36 shows the distribution of both recipients as well as total or average state grant awards over time. You can see in terms of fiscal year 12, we are approximately at the same level we were in fiscal year 99 in terms of grants, average grant awarded. In terms of number of recipients, though, the number of recipients have grown from 61,000 approximately to over 95,000 last year. This is the distribution of state grant dollars by institution type over that same 15-year time frame. And this is the distribution according to percents on slide 38. So that's just a percentage distribution of total spending by sector. Before 2004, we classified institutions based on whether they were a two-year institution or a four-year institution. In 2004, we switched to classify them by for-profit, non-profit, because the students could be attending a two-year or a four-year program at the same institution. The next section of the presentation talks a little bit about our state grant projections on slide 39. The Office of Higher Education is mandated to report to the legislature on November 1st and February 15th of each year what our projected spending is for the current year as well as essentially the rest of the biennium. For this year on February 15th, we also projected out for the next biennium. In terms of how we project, we incorporate changes with regards to the eligibility parameters as well as the federal Pell Grant, the federal needs analysis, and the tuition fees assessed by the institution. We make two non-policy changes in terms of projections. We do use data from Minnesota Management and Budget to project the change in wages of Minnesota residents, so we can get some gauge of how income income is changing within our applicant pool, as well as enrollment by institution. So in terms of
Ms. Fergus, just stop for a second.
Yep.
How do the reciprocity agreements, for instance, the one with North Dakota, impact the grant program? Does it impact it in any way as far as using it to leverage money for the reciprocity agreements?
Directly, no. Students who are are eligible for reciprocity are those Minnesota residents attending a North Dakota or Wisconsin institution, and so they would not receive a state grant. or North Dakota, Wisconsin residents attending a Minnesota institution, and they would not receive a state grant.
So, Ms. Ferguson, is the grant program ever used as a way of dealing with reciprocity and then paying it back?
We have used it in terms of a transfer of funds. I am blanking on when we did that.
Ms. Grimes may want to come up at this point.
Mr. Chairman, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. I would have to double check, but to my recollection, we transferred about $2.5 million in funds in fiscal 12 to help pay the obligation to North Dakota, which increased.
And Ms. Grimes, what's the obligation this year to North Dakota?
I have to get back to you on that. I'm sorry, sir. I don't remember off the top
of
my head.
It's okay. All right. Ms. Ferguson, proceed.
Essentially, what we are projecting for the remainder of this year is that we will be within appropriations, rather close from our perspective. This is kind of the number where we hold our breath when we're this close, just for cash flow reasons. And then for the next biennium, we also project that using current eligibility parameters in law, we will be within available appropriations with a 4.2% kind of reserve.
Ms. Ferguson, you said next biennium. That's assuming no increase, so you're not factoring in the governor's projected $80 million increase in the grant program?
Correct, Mr. Chair. This does not factor in the governor's recommendation. This is simply eligibility in current law.
All right. Thank you.
So the next section is that I did prepare some additional slides that you should have just received on the interaction of Minnesota State grants and part-time students.
All right, let's make sure everybody finds this one since it just came out. There's no date on it, but if there were, it would be March 11th.
It would be March 11th, like 12:05 p.m.
Yeah, but there's no date on it, so this is where she's going to go to next.
Okay. And these are some slides we put together just over the last few days to kind of talk about specifically the treatment of part-time students within the state grant program. The first thing to be aware of is that part-time is essentially based on a definition of full-time. And between 1983 and 1992, Minnesota defined full-time as 12 semester credits or the equivalent. This is the same as current federal policy. In 1993, the definition in Minnesota was changed to 15 credits. Federal definition is, of course, 12 credits. And part of that federal definition is that to receive a federal Pell Grant, you must be taking one or more credits. And to have eligibility for federal student loans, you must be taking six or more credits, so half times that. In terms of the different Pell Grant, the 12 credit threshold for Pell Grant and the 15 credit threshold for state grant, there is some interaction that you need to be aware of. Pell Grant awards grants based on credit bands. So they award a grant for those students who are 1 to 5 credits.
Ms. Ferguson, just pause for a second. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ferguson, can you elaborate a little bit as to why, going back to that previous slide, why the definition changed? From full-time, for full-time, from 12 to 15 credits?
Ms. Ferguson?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, if you actually jump ahead to page slide 46, you'll see the rationale for that. We analyzed some historical documents done by the Minnesota Higher Education Coordinating Board, and they noted that there were three rationales for changing the definition from 12 to 15. The first is that the full-time definition is actually used to determine the student's cumulative eligibility for state grant. So if they are eligible for 12 credits, then it is tied to 8 semesters of eligibility, which is a total eligibility of 96 credits. They were finding out that students were running out of eligibility for state grant before they ever achieved a bachelor's degree. So that's why moving it to 15 credits then aligned with the 120 credits needed for a bachelor's degree. In addition, the report noted that Minnesota completion rates were lagging behind other states. And the legislature saw that as an incentive to provide an incentive for full-time enrollment in order to increase those completion rates. In addition, the 15-credit definition did result in reduced grants to some students, which freed up some funds in order to other policy changes to be made, specifically increasing the living and miscellaneous expense allowance. So there was kind of a parallel policy change made there.
Representative Lee.
Right.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, that was just touched on. A big part of that initiative was to try to move us in a more timely completion direction, having been involved with it in 1993.
Ms. Ferguson?
Mr. Chair, just to jump back to the Pell Grant eligibility. The Pell Grant awards its grants in bands, so we're back on slide 43 of the new packet, which essentially means that there's a single award for students in the 1 to 5 credit range, 6 to 8, 9 to 11, and then 12 or above. What this means, if a student were to choose to change their enrollment from 9 credits to 8 credits, they would see a substantial decline in their Pell Grant, approximately a 25% decline. Minnesota adjusts its grants in order to partially offset those, and we do the 1 credit incremental change. So when you have the combined change, you actually have a smoother, steady increase in combined Pell Grants and state grants. So the two kind of policies work in conjunction that way. In terms of Minnesota State Grant, this is Minnesota State Grant applicants by enrollment level. This is a time trend from 1994 fall term through 2011. You can see that overall that there is a downward trend in enrollment at the 15 credit level. Originally in fall 1994, 65% of state grant applicants were considered at the 15 credits or more. There's also an upward trend in enrollment at the 12 to 14 credit threshold. In 1994, 20% of students enrolled in 12 to 14 credits. That has now increased to 30%.
Ms. Fergus, there's a... Oh, I see what you're doing. All right. Proceed. Okay. Your slide. Representative Norton.
Yes. Just quickly to this point, is there any difference between the MNSCU, the university, and the private colleges with regard to this information? And I'll let you answer and let's see if you get to my point.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, yes. It's on the next slide. We did it by a number of factors, so you can kind of see. The other thing I would point out is that the majority of students who apply for a Minnesota State Grant, meaning they complete the FAFSA, still enroll for 12 or more credits. It's approximately 75% of those who apply for the program. We have also seen an increase in the number of students enrolled for 6 to 11 credits, 6 credits being that federal student loan eligibility threshold. Those are likely adult learners taking one or two classes, or two to three classes. So that is the trend we have been seeing over time as well. In terms of sector, getting at Representative Norton's question, we have seen substantial change in the enrollment of students at the 15 credit level by institution type. So you can see in 2002-2003, when the U moved to its 13 credit policy, we saw a substantial increase in the number of students enrolled in 15 or more credits from that point forward. In 1999, approximately 49% of University of Minnesota students enrolled in 15 credits or more in fall term. Currently, that is more than 71%. In addition, we see that independent students are largely enrolling at the private for-profit institutions as well as MNSCU two-year institutions, and we have seen a steady decline in enrollment at the 15 credit level as a result of those students coming into the system. Both systems had rates that were in the mid-40s prior, and now they're currently in the 20 to 26% range of students enrolled at 15 credits or more. The one takeaway I would add is that what you're likely seeing here is a mix of both messaging to the students, financial factors, and overall time obligations. It's not clear cut that it's a need for more funding, but rather probably a mix of other items as well. I wanted to add this slide in that if you simply looked at the percent of applicants enrolling at 12 or more credits, the federal definition of full-time, which is the strongest policy for full-time that we have, you can see that more than 90% of students at MNSCU 4 years, the University of Minnesota, and private nonprofit institutions are enrolled at 12 or more credits. It is largely the MNSCU 2 years and the private for-profits where you see large numbers of part-time students. We also looked at enrollment by credit level by family type. The red line represents dependent students. That line has been relatively stable over the past 10 years, from about 62% in fall 2002 to 58% in fall 2011. However, for the other groups, independent students, those with and without children, those married and those single, you can see a substantial decline in enrollment at the full-time level over time. So between 30 and 39% in 2002 to currently 16 to 23%. So that is probably where the enrollment activity is concentrated for part-time students, is among independent students. Um, The other thing I would add in terms of the definition of full-time is that it is a, as Representative Carlson noted, it is a timely completion factor. For students to graduate in 4 years with a bachelor's degree, they would need to complete 15 credits per semester. If that were to move down to 12 credits, as it is in federal policy, it would take approximately 5 years to complete a bachelor's degree. The other thing we looked at is income of students by credit level. And this is because we kind of wanted to target are lower income students taking fewer credits to kind of get at that financial factor. And what we can see is that if you look at just independent students, the income levels do not vary greatly among whether students take one credit or students take 15 credits. They're in the same income band. So for the first circle there, independent students who are married with dependents, you can see the income range is $38,000 for 15 credits and then goes up to approximately $47,000 for 6 to 8 credits. That same pattern is seen across all independent students. So we would add that you should consider non-financial factors when we're talking about enrollment levels of part-time students.
Ms. Fergus, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't quite agree with the conclusion that the income doesn't vary significantly. Looking at independent married with dependents, a range from $38,500 up to $47,500, and in that income range, that's a fairly significant change. You also mentioned things like child care. As a non-income-based factor, but of course that is entirely an income-based factor, because if you could afford to work or not work at all and put your children in child care full-time and go to school, you would be able to get done more quickly. And I think, as I just look through here quickly, it looks like the students with the highest number of credits have the lowest income, and there is quite a significant difference between all of them. So I don't know that I agree with the contention. It seems to me that it is predicated mostly on finance of those individuals.
Ms. Fergus?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, you are correct in that the range is there, $38,000 to $47,000. Yes, we would agree that is a substantial range. And you're right that the largest number of students in those groups are at the 1 to 5 credit level. The 1 to 5 credit level, they're likely receiving minimal federal grants, minimal state grants, as well as no student loans. So they are truly paying all costs out of pocket. The one point I wanted to make, though, is that you can't necessarily say that it's all about grant funding. That at these income levels, I would not say that any of these students are less needy than other students. I would like to see, of course, I don't control the money, but substantial increases for all students, both full-time and part-time, within certain categories of students. I don't believe that we'd necessarily do enough for them. But in terms of stating that students who are full-time have more financial resources than students who are part-time, I just don't see that as being true. And you are correct. When I mentioned child care, I was thinking more about the availability of child care options during class times. But you're correct. The financial factor is a key one as well for child care.
Representative Winkler? Representative Franz?
No.
All right. Ms. Fergus, if we held tuition to no increase at all, or actually decreased it, would that be better than putting money into the grant program?
Are we talking tuition freezes across all institutions?
I don't like using the word freeze. Okay. Let's say we invested in such a way that we would pay for tuition increases by the state, and therefore there would not be an increase to the students.
Mr. Chair, I would defer to Director Kogelman on that one.
I was hoping you would. Director Pogemiller.
Ms. Chairman, I think dollar for dollar, I think the argument is that that's an inefficient use of your dollar, because in some instances you would be over-subsidizing somebody on a higher income than somebody on a lower income who would get direct state aid through the grant program.
So Director Pogemiller, helping everyone by keeping tuition stable or even decreasing it would be, in your estimation, a poor investment, and then helping a few by investing in the grant program would be a better investment.
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't use the word better or worse. I would say less targeted. because to the extent that you spend money to hold tuition down for everybody, you are unable to target those most in need.
So you really don't have a choice, Director Pogemiller. If we don't, tuition is going to go up, and then we'd have to put more money into the grant program. You're in sort of a vicious cycle here, aren't you? So you'd rather see tuition go up and invest in the grant program. So where does it end?
Well, no, I think what you want is tuition to be suppressed or held down at the same time you invest in the grant program. That's what you want.
It's a draconian choice, but we've had apparently only one option the last few years. We've cut and we've cut and we've cut, and we've kept the grant program away from the cuts. But the tuition increases have been incestuous. They have been ceaseless. So something's got to give here. We can either keep feeding the monster or we can try to tame it.
Mr. Chairman, this gets back to the point I was trying to make the other day, which is, what is your ability as a legislature and a governor with the amount of money available to manage tuition increases? And I think you just need to make a judgment. At which point, I mean, in a perfect world, you'd have free tuition.
We did about 25 years ago at the tech colleges.
And Mr. Chairman, it seems to me the policy issue is, can you get to that again? Are there enough resources to do that? Or are you confronted with a different choice, which I believe is a more targeted, which I believe you're confronted with? You either target or you try to go back to a time that may not exist any longer. But with enough money, you absolutely could go back there.
Director Pogemiller, that will be probably the choice before us. We can help everyone or a few. And one way or another, we'll have to come to grips with it. Ms. Fergus, you want to proceed?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Greenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Pogemiller, this is just a thought. What if the legislature tied the additional funding to an average on tuition? If the tuition stayed on average the same, giving you some flexibility within different courses and income groups, but on average it would need to stay the same, or even a reduction of 2%, is that something that would be manageable on your end?
Director Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that that would affect the grant program as much as whether the institution or the stakeholder institutions can manage that, and whether that's a good thing for them to do or not. So I think I would put that outside of the discussion we were having just now about your choice. And I think that's more of an issue to deal directly with the institutions on, and whether they think that makes sense for them to have different tuition levels for different types of degrees or different types of programs.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. There was a question that came up in a previous committee meeting here, and your name was connected with it, so I thought I'd ask it now, and that was when I was on the school board quite a few years ago, there was a proposal to tie consequences to the number of high school graduates who went on to higher education that needed remedial math and reading. And Mr. Chair, is that appropriate to bring that question up?
It certainly is.
Okay. And we had a statistic of 38% of students who need remedial math and reading. I had talked to my local Ridgewater College, and they had said somewhere between 35 and 40, and the percent that was shared that day was 38% across the system. So, and your name was brought up in terms of the supporting a proposal that K-12 educational systems would have to pick up the cost of remedial math and reading, and remedial math and English. And it gave my superintendent a tremendous amount of angst at the time. Okay, he had a hard time sitting still until that didn't go through. And do you think something like that would be helpful? What I find with human nature is consequences produce much better results than just encouragement in most cases.
This might be Senator Pogemiller on this one.
It was.
Director Pogemiller.
It was, Mr. Chairman, and I think that's about a decade. That had to be in like the mid-90s somewhere.
I have a long memory.
And very good. And Mr. Chairman,
which is appreciated, Representative Grenade.
The thought was, I remember working with, I think it was Senator Larson and Senator Janicich at the time, and the thought was the higher ed institutions come in and say, we need extra money because we have to remediate students who came out of Minnesota high schools with a diploma but needed remediation. And a no-cost way to find out what was going on was to put in law something that said, well, if the student has a Minnesota diploma and needs remediation, maybe we should ask the high school to pay for that remediation because they didn't get the job done in the first instance. And I think that actually was in law for a while, and no higher ed institution, as I understand it, actually billed back the high school. And so I think that did tell us something about that discussion. I think what it tells you is that, in my judgment, it tells you that both sides would like to tell us they need more money to do a particular job, but when you ask whether somebody is willing to be held accountable for that, then they think the issue is much more complex.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'd agree with that summary that you gave. The point is, when we had the discussion the other day when you weren't here, these remediation classes, actually, the student is picking up the cost for him also, so it adds to his debt load. And I just think, personally, something needs to be done. I mean, he goes to, K-12, graduates, and, to me, 38% is unacceptable. A certain percentage is understandable. But, here we're talking about debt on the students and tuition. And here students have to retake what they've been doing, we're supposed to learn in the last 12 years. And to me, some type of consequence with accountability does make sense. So,
Mr. Director Pogamiller.
Director Pogamiller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I do think it's a more complex issue than that rough test that we had put in 95 or whatever year that was. And I think Chancellor Rosenstone and Commissioner Casilius are stepping up to that toughness with their discussion and their attempt to work with you on redesigning what happens in that transition from high school to post-secondary, and trying to earlier identify the students that are not on the path and try to intervene in a way so that they don't need remediation. On the same token, freeing up students who are not engaged because they've already done everything they can in high school. And so I think what the chancellor and the commissioner are talking about is a sophisticated way to deal with the issue that we've all been talking about, too much remediation in post-secondary. And I'm hoping the legislature, and I know the legislature is interested in working with them on that.
Okay. Representative Grenagan.
Well, just to throw it out there for food for thought and for the committee and also for yourselves. Because, to me, so much of our discussion is centered on the tuition and the debt that the students are accumulating, and if we get 38% of the students that have to take this over and then pile on debt on top of it, it just seems there should be some consequence somewhere other than just to the student and tuition in the system. That was just food for thought for people to think about. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director Pogamiller, your comments about two groups coming and having needs and they may not be exactly what should be funded apply to state agencies too, just so you know. Representative Norton.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as we were just talking a little bit ago about the high tuition, high grant, where do we put our money, as I look back at all the information that's been provided, and there's a lot of it, and I appreciate that. It's great. I fear what we do when we don't freeze tuition is we're able then to help people at the low end, and people at the high end have their own means. But the kids in the middle and the families in the middle are the ones that increasing tuition prices are going to have the biggest effect on. I think just raising the tuition rate, no matter whether there's grant money or Pell Grant money or any money available, is a deterrent for some students of lower income because they think, I'll never be able to qualify. But I think when you start looking at what happens to those kids in the center, to me, that's where the high tuition, high grant formula doesn't work. And there's just a variety of them. When you start getting to the 40 to the 70,000 range, if you're a family, that seems like a lot of money perhaps, but if you've got two or three, or in my instance, four kids going to college at the same time, that isn't reasonable. And there isn't the help for those kids that there need to be. And it means that group of kids, those middle-income kids, are the ones that have the most loans as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Director Pogemiller.
Representative, if you would refer back to Chart 33 that Ms. Vergas went through, you have hit on the head with a hammer what the state grant program does. And the distribution of money, the state grant program cannot overcome a too low Pell grant. What it can do is move help into the lower middle class. And that's precisely what it does.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Narden.
And I do appreciate that. But again, your first statement is what I'm getting at. When the tuition price goes up and the Pell grants are not available, the little bit extra for state grant is appreciated, but not having tuition go up at all might be more appreciated by some of those families.
Director Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, the issue, there's no disagreement on the side of myself or our office that it would be good to hold down both the list price and the actual price, net price, of post-secondary education. Absolutely. The issue is being realistic about what you can and can't do as a state policymaker. And the point we tried to make in a previous discussion several days ago was to not, in my judgment and in our judgment in our office, do not overestimate your ability to control price in the higher ed marketplace over the long term. And so you need to make a choice. If you can't control the price or hold it down because you don't have enough money to basically buy down all the public institutions, or two, the nonprofit institutions don't really care what you do because they're doing something else based on the Purdue experience. They raised their tuition because they thought they had to tell somebody they had to have a high tuition so they would good students would choose their institution. So the point isn't that we shouldn't try to figure out ways to encourage institutions to maintain efficiency so they can have a low price. The issue is, what can you control and what can't you control? And the argument I would make is that there's a lot of evidence that your ability to control the price is a lot less than policymakers want it to be. But you need to accept that and then make the decision, should we target our resources? Or should we continue to tell people we can control the price?
Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this point may have already been made, and Representative Grunhagen is now out of the room. But I would suggest that in the mid-90s, when we looked at charging K-12 for the cost of remediation, that responsibility was misplaced. And the main issue that was not appropriately analyzed at that point was the question of alignment. What does it mean to get the job done? What the post-secondary system thought it meant and what the K-12 system had defined did not align. So where the responsibility lies was in both directions, and I think we've recognized that, and I think that is exactly what's being worked on with high school redesign and the redesign of the assessment system. And so I hope that people will see that we're able to reduce the costs of remediation by shared responsibility.
And Mr. Chairman.
Director Pogemiller.
Well stated. That's exactly the point. And I think you have seen less blaming from the post-secondary, just blaming K-12, partly because that was pointed out when they didn't try to ask the K-12 system to reimburse them. They did understand it was more complex.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pogemiller, your point about the inability of the public sector to control the increased cost of tuition because of the tuition marketplace. If there is a market, which I don't think there really is, because I think the people who sell credits in higher education have a group of buyers who have no choice but to buy them, so it's not really a market. But to the extent it is a market, if the University of Minnesota and Minsky campuses reduce their price, does that not put some pressure on higher education, the private nonprofits, to be somewhat responsive to that, or risk the best and brightest students deciding it's just a much better deal to go to the University of Minnesota?
Representative Director Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, I do think there's a market in place, and I think that students choose lower cost alternatives if they think the value is worth it. On the other hand, there's a lot of evidence that people with resources, here's the best example, somebody pays in the mid 40s to go to, let me just pick on Harvard. I was going to pick a local one, but I won't. Let's just pick on Harvard. Knowing full well that the full cost of a baccalaureate at Harvard is not $45,000. They know that, but they still choose it. So I do believe there's a market going on. I do believe people are making choices between higher costs, lower costs, and they are adding their belief of the value.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pogemiller, the evidence for the fact that there really isn't a market is that the tuition at every single institution, public or private, is on a steady upward march, regardless of circumstances or consequences.
Oh.
So that would indicate that there's really the purchasing side of the marketplace really has no choice but to pay whatever the institutions feel they should charge.
Oh. Director Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, point well taken. That, though, I think is evidence that you don't have as much control as you think. Because look at California, where the most low-cost students in the country are, and they have gotten to the point where they no longer can, apparently, have decided, either can't or have chosen not to basically offer free tuition. And it may be that they've just chosen not to. But I think in the circumstance state governments are in, it appears that it's not just that they don't want to, it's that they apparently don't believe they can do that any longer. So I do think that's evidence of a market system. But I agree with your point, Representative, that there are tendencies there that apparently there are people who are willing to pay no matter what. And I think that's where policymakers need to look and decide the equities between that in terms of how the world values, the marketplace values those different types of degrees from different types of institutions. I believe that's the argument for charging it through grant money.
No more questions, so Ms. Fergus, you want to proceed since we sidetracked you a bit?
One of the options that we're frequently asked about is how would state grants change if Minnesota moved back to the 12 credit limit? So what I have before you is an example, which is on slide 53. That essentially shows Winona State University students, single, no children. The income is $26,000. Their expected family contribution based on the federal need analysis is $5,882, which puts them outside of Pell Grant eligibility. Minnesota State Grant, we assume their family can contribute $4,000 a year to their educational costs, with a tuition of $8,983 for next year estimated. The first column shows you the calculation for a full-time student. They would receive a Minnesota State grant of $4,631. If the student were to drop down to 9 credits, they would receive a grant of $1,178. If we move to 12 credits, the full-time student sees no change in their award, and the part-time student sees an increase in their state grant to $2,473. The one thing I would add is that the annual cost to make this change is $60 million per year in the state grant program.
Ms. Fergus, why don't you just repeat that one more time?
$60 million per year, $120 million for the biennium.
I appreciate the doubling, so folks know how much it does cost. And Ms. Fergus, next time you might want, it is down at the bottom, but you may want to think in biennial terms too when you do this.
Oh,
so
sure.
If it's, because we would look at that and say it's 30-30, and obviously it's 60-60. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right. I will. The second kind of policy lever you have in terms of part-time students is that assigned family responsibility. And I just to reiterate, the assigned family responsibility is the expected payment responsibilities of families based on their income and their assets. It does not change by enrollment level. It is standard for families with the same income and similar assets. We consider this as establishing equity in the program in terms of what families can contribute. This also allows the student to choose what is the best enrollment level for them rather than the state. The one question we would raise is that are students who enroll for fewer than 15 credits needier than students who are enrolled in part full-time? If we want to vary that AFR, it does imply that they are needier. In addition, we would note that the AFR may be too high for all students. That $4,000 you saw in the prior example may be too high for all students, both full-time and part-time. Also, the lowest income students have an AFR of zero. It's just the income range with that zero occurs does vary. So what you can see in the next slide on the example, the same student, you can see that that AFR line is the same for both students, whether they're at 15 credits or at 9 credits. We do not vary. They have similar income and similar assets. The AFR, of course, can be reduced overall. So you could choose to change that $4,000 to a number that is more reasonable for both students in this example. The next slide just kind of goes back to these are the assessment assignments that the federal policy determines. So for that orange line, which is the student example, at the $50,000 in income, we do expect them to contribute on a federal level 30% of their income. For students who are married with children, it goes down to 3% of their income. Minnesota in session law buys those numbers down. Minnesota only requires that the student contribute 20% of the income for an independent student not married and no children. However, if you actually look at that 20%, it's 20% of a $50,000 income, so that would be $10,000 per year, which is an enormous amount of resources. So the other option we would have you consider is that the overall net price, rather than looking at just the grant amount, look at the net cost to the students from the example. So for the full-time student receiving $4,631, they have a net price of $11,352 at the end of the day. For a part-time student whose state grant is $1,178, they have a net cost of $8,411. So even though the full-time student is receiving a higher state grant, they do have higher out-of-pocket costs as compared to the part-time student. One of the other options we were asked to do is what if we change...
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But the make sure I'm following this. Your conclusion that they have the full-time student has a higher out-of-pocket cost is true, but they're also getting a lot more credits.
Correct, Ms. Ferguson. Mr. Chair, Representative. They are receiving 15 credits, yes. They are taking more credits.
Okay. So I think the comparison that would be useful would be on a per-credit basis.
One of the options we are asked to consider is if we were to change the AFR based on enrollment level, and we have the same first two columns for that Winona State University student example, and then we actually change the AFR for the columns on the right so that the student in the 9 credit column is actually only paying 60% of the AFR as compared to the student in the full-time column. So this actually does increase their Minnesota State grant and it does decrease their net price. The annual cost for this is $17 million, so biannually $34 million for this type of change. That is all I have for you today, Mr. Chair. Are there any other questions?
Any final questions of the Office of Higher Ed? No. Seeing none, then thank you very much, Director Pogemiller, Ms. Grimes, thank you, and we'll be having you back when we put the final bill together. At this point, we're going to have a report that everyone's been waiting for on the administrative costs at the university. And I think you have a binder that the university provided today on the administrative structural analysis and cost. It's a three-ring binder. President Kaler is here, and I don't know who's going to be with him, but welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and then where you want us to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you'll give me a minute for a technology update.
Just as a reminder, members, this report came about as a result of a Wall Street Journal article that gained some notoriety, and then Senator Bach and Senator Bonhoff sent a letter to the university Governor Dayton then also had a stipulation where his budget request was going to be limited based on this report. So this report has gained a great deal of publicity, and President Kaler is going to walk us through it today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Kaler. I am a 1982 graduate of the University of Minnesota, and for the past 20 months I've been honored to be the president of our state's only comprehensive research university. Please allow me to acknowledge members of the university's Board of Regents who are here, Regents Devine and Beeson, and I believe I saw a regent recently, Emerite Ramirez. Thank you for coming. So, Mr. Chair, I'm here to talk about two important issues, and in the interest of time, I'm going to move quickly through the administrative cost study, take your questions, and also present the university's biennial budget request. And as soon as we get the right presentation up here, I'll begin. But in the interest of time, let me also then briefly place this work in the context of our university's overall approach to operational excellence, which is something I focused on long before any misleading news reports emerged about the university. And our budget request has two goals. One is to halt rise of tuition for our students and their families, and to advance research that will strengthen our state and our industries. And so our request is fundamentally about what we do every day and will continue to do for the people of Minnesota and its innovation economy in all 87 counties. Mr. Chairman, you have frequently asked me about the state's disinvestment in the University of Minnesota. If the state of Minnesota continues to reduce its partnership with the University of Minnesota, tuition will rise. You ask us what hard decisions have been made, and that's the very hardest decision. But as is the case across the nation, a university cannot make budget cuts of the size we have seen, and coming so quickly, without rupturing our faculty, eroding our quality, derailing our students' progress, and ultimately harming the institution. So to offset state disinvestment and maintain our quality, we have had to ask students and families to pay more. At the same time, the U has made cuts, program reductions, salary freezes, furloughs, and a reduction in health care benefits, among other reductions. Before I became president, on three separate occasions since 2003, the university implemented retirement incentive programs with millions of dollars in savings as we faced budget cuts. We reduced benefits to 25,000 employees on all of our campuses. A good example, a recent audit of employee-dependent health coverage saved us $1 million. We imposed wage freezes and pay reductions for some employees. Since fiscal year 2009-10, the university implemented two wage freezes and a temporary salary reduction in fiscal 11. College of Veterinary Medicine, as just one example, cut about 110 positions, or 15% of its staff, since fiscal 2009. Currently, there are 62 tenure-track faculty, down from 72 in 2002. Increased class sizes, reduced research activity. We are, by the way, the busiest academic veterinary clinic in the nation, and the state's only College of Veterinary Medicine graduating 100%
of new veterinary. President Kaler, just pause for just 1 second, please. I want members to know there are two items in your packet. There's this folder, and I think the slides he's working off of now are in this folder. Then there's the three-ring binder that has the summary of the administrative costs. So we're just going to catch up to you just for a second here. So you're looking for this folder, members, and then I think this is the first slide on page 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did not mean to bring a blizzard of paper. Thank you for getting us on track. And I'll just read a few more examples for you. Between 08 and 11, student credit hours expanded by 35% in the College of Science and Engineering, while departmental budgets were reduced. Those are just a sample, but I am committed to keeping tuition down, and I'm asking for your help in doing that. In 2011-12, my first year on the job, as we managed another state cut, we increased tuition by only 3.5%. The lowest increase in a dozen years, and nearly 5 percentage points lower than the national average for tuition increases among public universities. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you are unable to partner with us to freeze tuition, we will do everything we can to keep the rate of tuition increase low, but we simply cannot provide the excellence that this state deserves from its research university without an investment in the case of flat or eroding state investment. In recent years, funding for higher education on a per capita basis has dropped by 23% across the nation. But as you've seen previously in the session at, in the state of Minnesota, our reduction is 48%. Most recent comparison of the 50 states by their appropriation for higher education per $1,000 of personal income, Minnesota now ranks 30th. Mississippi now spends nearly twice as much as we do per $1,000 of personal income, $10.02 versus $5.35. Governor Dayton recently said, quote, "No wonder tuitions keep rising, making Minnesota college education less and less affordable for students and their families. That is not what I want, and I don't believe it's what you want. And so today I'm asking for a renewed partnership to lessen the burden on Minnesota students and families. We cannot do it alone. It's what private institutions do. We need to put the public back in public higher education. I don't believe that an organization can be cut.
Excuse me one second. Representative Johnson has a question.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can wait if you wish.
Well, as long as we've stopped, why don't you ask it now and then.
Here's my question as I listen to you speak is, after having listened to Director Pogemiller talk about the state's the difficulty or inability really to control tuition, I'm just interested in your response to his comments in that regard, that it's kind of a, to some extent, a fruitless mission to pursue that in a very direct fashion.
Representative Johnson, Chair Pulaski, I'm here to ask your help to do exactly that. We have indicated a dollar need that if we are awarded it in this biennium, we will hold tuition constant. Too often in this conversation, I think you are asked for money and you're not told what it's going to buy. What are you getting for your dollar? And I'm telling you, for these dollars we're requesting, we will hold tuition flat for the biennium for Minnesota resident undergraduate students.
President Kaler, and I think everyone should be reminded that your budget request came out this summer, well before the election, realizing that there was an issue here of tuition, regardless of who was in control of the legislature. So that is also appreciated, that you had recognized it way in advance of the session and the election.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is critically important to me personally, if I can take this aside. An excellent public education needs to be available for qualified students in the state of Minnesota, and it needs to be accessible. We cannot and should not continue to increase tuition for our undergraduate students. It's not fair. It's not sustainable. I can't do it by myself. As you'll see as I move through here, we're proposing to move $28 million out of administrative into mission costs, but I need some help. Let me tell you briefly about operational excellence, which is our long-term commitment to work smarter, reduce costs, enhance services, and increase revenues throughout the university system. We need to use our people, our money, our time, our facilities to the highest purpose possible to move money out of administrative costs into what's most important, teaching, research, and public engagement. Now, as you know, in January, Senators Bonhoff and Bach asked the university to use an external consultant to analyze the so-called spans and layers of our management structure. The senators asked us, for a start, to examine four administrative functions: finance, human resources, information technology, and purchasing. Now, given the short time frame, we looked at those central offices, and we will complete an analysis of the functions across the university by summer. They also asked us to engage in a benchmarking and diagnostic study of our administrative structure against peer institutions, and I will be presenting those findings to Senator Bonhoff's committee tomorrow. But briefly, according to outside experts, in the four units reviewed, the university has the appropriate number of layers in from the top to the bottom. And overall, over all sectors, the number of employees reporting to a supervisor is 6.1 on average. But we also learned in those three of those four units, the number of employees that report to each supervisor is somewhat lower than recommended for higher education organizations. It was helpful data developed by the outside expert Simpson Consulting, and we will use it to be more efficient, reduce costs, and redirect resources. We're still completing the benchmarking study of these administrative units, But once all the data is complete, we will make it public, and we will use it to better align our management and our employees so we service our students and the state of Minnesota more effectively. And while we're talking about administrative structure and the ratio of supervisors, I want to take time to address one of the most referenced alleged facts in a media report last December. And that allegation was that we added more than 1,000 quote-unquote administrators to our workforce since 2001. That is simply not true. Not true. I don't want to get in the weeds on this, but I want you to know something about our efficiency. Within every department, there are various ways to record expenses. There's an expense category called academic support. When faculty members are entered into our budget system, a few of our units paid them from accounts labeled as academic support. What should have happened is the budget should have moved those dollars from academic support to faculty salaries. They would have been coded correctly. We didn't do that. That's our mistake. Messes up how we could report data over time. But when you look at those 1,000 or so additional employees called administrators, 354 of them are faculty members. Second important point. Of the remaining group, more than half were in fact administrators, but they were not supported by either state or tuition dollars, but rather from other funds such as federal grants and contracts or auxiliary funds. The reporter didn't ask or write about the source of the salary. A director of patient care services in our clinics or the director of the Institute on the Environment would be examples of these types of employees. The remaining 340 or so were hired over the course of a decade. That's 34 a year. And they are, in fact, our administrators. They perform critical support roles that have led to increased graduation rates, better retention rates, an increase in research expenditures of 40% over just the past 5 years, and roles that are often required by federal compliance. Other context, over that period, our enrollment's grown by 9,000 students, and we recently added a completely new campus in Rochester.
Excuse me again, President Kaler. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, could you give examples? So of the 354 who are miscoded faculty, is it true that all 354 are full-time faculty members and it was just simply a miscoding, or is it people with a mix of duties?
Representative Winkler,
President Chair
Pawlowski, my understanding is that those are faculty members. Some faculty members, in fact, many faculty members, also take on some extra capacity as a center director or an associate chair throughout the university. But their primary function is being a faculty member, not an administrator.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, President Kaler, what about a situation? I have friends in the general counsel's office. If somebody in the general counsel's office teaches one course at the law school, are they faculty or are they administration? Or is there a differential in time that kind of puts one in one category or another in another category?
President Kaler.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler. There certainly is a gray area as people take on responsibilities one way or the other. I believe someone doing that kind of teaching would be primarily their principal salary would be from the general counsel's office. That's what I would count them as their duty. But we would also tally them as an adjunct instructor for that semester in the law school.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And President Kaler, I guess the final question on your second bullet point, the 53% not supported by state tuition or state funds. First of all, just a general observation, which is that money's fungible. That's the whole idea behind it. So in some cases it's not if you have a dedicated donation or something like that. So I guess the question is, of this 53% not supported by state or tuition funds, is it all of it from a dedicated donation that has to be used for a specific purpose, or is there no flexibility in those numbers at all?
President Kaler.
Representative Winkler, Chair Pawlowski. My understanding is those dollars are dedicated to specific purposes. An example would be you are awarded a federal research grant to execute a certain piece of work. you hire somebody, it's a big dollar amount, you hire somebody paid by that grant to manage activity in the grant. Great example. Suppose you have a grant that requires you to study human subjects. You would hire somebody as the director of the human subject activity there. They would be listed, but they would be paid for by those grant funds, and those grant funds by law can't be used for anything else. Another example, you grow the number of meals you serve in a dining hall, and you add an additional supervisor because you have more employees. That person is paid from the auxiliary funds generated by the person who bought the meal. Those funds can't be moved to other purposes.
Representative Winkler.
So, Mr. Chair, President Kaler, I'm not going to ask sort of a deposition-like question, but I mean, your general statement here is that this 53% in your bullet point is generally money that is non-fungible. It has to be used for whatever purpose the university collected, and it can't be exchanged for other university resources.
President Kaler.
Representative Winkler, Chair Pulaski, that is my understanding, yes.
Okay, thank you.
President Kaler, what would have happened had there been no Wall Street Journal article? You raised the issue of administration when you first came to the university as president, so can you just briefly tell us what would have happened had there been no Wall Street Journal article?
Chair Pulaski, as you may know, on the first day of the first week of the first semester of my first year here, I met with my organizational leaders to start an operational excellence program. And we would be driving that as hard as we're driving it now, with or without the Wall Street Journal article. We've been working on this for 20 months.
President Kaler, this report, though, has cost $48,000 and then subsequently $400,000+ more. Would you have spent that money on a study of administration had there not been a Wall Street Journal report and the Bach and Bonhoff letter and the stipulation by Governor Dayton?
Chair Pulaski, I would have spent some money on this, indeed. The reason is because, like many businesses, we can benefit by a set of outside eyes that help us benchmark what we do. In addition, with regards to the benchmarking study, which is the larger dollar amount to which you refer, those consultants have access to databases from other organizations around the country with which we can compare. We don't have that database ourselves, so there's actual just informational value gotten by those kind of hires.
Okay. No. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, this maybe will just help me understand this a little bit better. You talked about the remaining employees, and one of these that you mentioned here is the program director for the Human Rights Institute. Human rights being a very important topic, does the Human Rights Institute, I don't know anything about it. I don't know if it offers credit, four credit classes if it's conducting research, or if it's just a center for scholarship, which is, of course, also acceptable. But how do you, what kind of role is that, this program director for the Human Rights Institute? Does it, presumably students are paying tuition to help support this position. How do you make an assessment of whether or not this position is worth the tuition that students are paying to support it?
President Kaler.
Representative Winkler, Chair Pulaski, we make that decision as we would do any academic investment. We tee up the opportunity for student education, for scholarship, for advancement of our public engagement mission, and make a decision of whether an investment of personnel in that activity brings benefits. It turns out that the Human Rights Institute is an important part of a campus-wide activity around human rights, an emerging area of scholarship and focus between the College of Liberal Arts and your alma mater, the law school, that I think will put us in a very important place to be a place of scholarship, a place of convening for people who are interested in this very important area.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Kaler, just to make clear, the point of the Human Rights Institute is scholarship. It's for faculty to engage other similar scholars around the world and to bring students together. But does it, we often think of sort of research and teaching, and obviously a lot of scholarship is not scientific research. It's just pure scholarship that universities are supposed to do without regard to necessarily a financial impact. But is this a place where is an institute where professors are coming together to write and students are getting four credit courses? or is it, I just don't know, because there's so many of these things out there, and I don't really know. The Institute on the Environment is another thing. I don't know how many four-credit courses they teach. I don't know how much scholarship or research they're conducting. I just, you know, I don't have a sense of that. And I know you did a study on the total number of these things out there, so I just wanted your sense on sort of how they fit in.
Representative Winkler, Chair Pulaski, I believe we have reached the limit of my knowledge of the Human Rights Institute, but we'd be happy to get you a briefing paper on that. You are right that as part of operational excellence, we've looked at all of our centers. We have well over 200 of them, and we're closing 9% of them because they've become irrelevant or can be merged into other activities. So these are things that we look at carefully. This is an emerging area of scholarship in which we are pleased to be doing work.
Right. President Kaler.
Thank you. Let me just walk through a couple of other statistics here just very quickly. Students per employee up almost 11%. Our headcount is relatively flat over the past decade, up 3%. Degrees per employee up 28%. Sponsored research dollars per employee up 41%. This is an institution that is more effective and more efficient than it has been, but it is an institution that can certainly become more effective and more efficient, and that's my goal. Next steps include completing the analysis of each function, reviewing each and every job to see that it's classified appropriately, represents the work being done, set goals for reducing layers and increasing spans of control, flattening the organization, adopting policies for better efficiency, and better training of managers. So again, ultimately, our goal is to reduce the percent of the university's resources used for administrative and managerial costs year over year. Throughout operational excellence, we have some other examples. And again, I don't want to bore you with them, but we've eliminated administrative offices, saving $2.2 million. Combining technology help desk and servers saved us $1.5 million in ongoing costs. Library consolidation in St. Paul. We've saved almost $17 million by modernizing contracts and procedures, $5.6 million in energy costs. We pioneered the use of Google Apps among the first university to do so, moving a move valued at more than $15 million a year in capacity. Closing 9% of our centers, as I mentioned, completed an external review of the Academic Health Center, launching a planning activity there, and partnered with the Board of Regents and adopted new executive compensation policies and oversight to eliminate large separation agreements and be the diligent stewards of public dollars that we need to be. There's much more to share, Mr. Chair, but I am not going to take the time to do it. I'm simply trying to illustrate that I'm not standing for the status quo, that we've done much in streamlining a complex organization, but we have a long way to go. I'll close with the observation that our economic impact on the state of Minnesota from a recent study was shown to be roughly $13.20 for every dollar invested by the state of Minnesota. If you believe that, you could argue that reducing our funding by $140 million, which has happened since 07, 08, is a reduction in the vitality of the Minnesota economy of $1.8 billion annually. Let me turn to my biennial request. Just to review, the University of Minnesota has five campuses, nearly 70,000 students, $800 million a year in research activity, and more than a quarter million living alumni in Minnesota and another quarter million around the world. The map shows our campuses with the block M's, our research and outreach centers are the squares, and the circles are regional extension offices. Many of them, of course, are in or near your district, or regional extension offices. Many of them, of course, are in or near your district, and they all support our threefold core mission: preparing Minnesota's best students for the jobs of tomorrow, for discovering new products, new processes, new ideas, new cures, and new treatments, and engaging in a multitude of ways in our statewide public outreach. From partnering with others to close the educational achievement gap, to counseling and supporting families across the state. So here are our goals for the biennial budget request. Putting our students and families first is the number one goal. We seek to cap tuition for Minnesota resident undergraduates, stemming an unsustainable rise. In the years before I arrived, this university raised tuition to compensate for state disinvestment and to invest in excellence. The data bears out the success of those investments. We used to be severely behind the Big Ten with low graduation rates. But by investing in student support, counselors, advising, orientation, first-year experience, and others, we've increased four-year graduations from 36% in 2000, 36%, to 60% today, and to 73% in 6 years. That is a remarkable improvement. We also now have a 90% retention rate for freshmen on the Twin Cities campus, and this year, a record number of applicants, 42,000 applications to the University of Minnesota, an increase of 15% from last year. Secondly, this request commits to delivering on performance and accountability measures and to reducing administrative costs. Third, we're asking for an investment in targeted research initiatives that are at the intersection of university strengths and opportunities for the state of Minnesota. And finally, our goal and role in Minnesota to prepare the next generation of health professionals. By forgiving debt, a portion of debt, on our health professional graduates who want to bring their skills to underserved communities across the state. And that's something we hear from you and your colleagues all the time, a shortage of health professionals in greater Minnesota. So in putting our budget request together, we ask the overarching question, how can we best secure Minnesota's future? That's a question you wrestle with every day, and we at the university wrestle with it too. I think that we must invest in our young people who will transform our economy and the state in the years ahead and the years after that. First, we propose 0% tuition increase. That is an incremental $14.2 million request. It's a biennial request each year, so the total is $42.6 million if you do biennial math. For an incoming student, that tuition freeze would mean, over the course of a four-year education, she would save $2,565 on our Twin Cities campus.
President Kaler, I'm just going to ask you to repeat the biennial number. We've been working for the better part of a week with our fiscal staff just on tuition and seeing what that number would be. So can you just repeat that?
Sure, Mr. Chair. It's $42.6 million biennially.
Yeah. Thank you.
That $2,500 of savings for that student is a big number for her.
Representative Reiner has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the point, it says freeze tuition for 14-15 state commits an incremental $14.2 million. 42.6 is three times that, so
yes.
I'm missing something.
Right.
Well, and I think President Kaler is going to tell you, and once we get into putting our budget together, this is the key when you're making a base adjustment. A base adjustment is not one-time money. This is a permanent adjustment to the university's base. So, President Kaler.
Thank you. Chair Plowski has answered that question. So it's a base increase, which means you have to give it to us year one, give it to us again in year two, and then a third part. It took me a little while to
learn
about
biennial math. Members, this is a key concept we have to continually remember when we begin to put the budget together. There is a huge difference between one-time money and base adjustments over a biennium. So that's what we want to make sure we're clear about when we start putting numbers together. Thank you, President Kaler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Representative Reiner, but we're going to keep reminding members of that, too.
Debt is the subject of the year, and that $2,500 needs to be put in perspective. A third of our graduates graduate debt-free. Two-thirds don't. And of the two-thirds who graduate with debt from the university, their average debt is $27,000. So taking a $2,500 chunk out of that potential debt is a big deal. Maybe the most important thing I have to show you today is this chart, and you've seen this chart in previous presentations. It shows the net cost of attendance in family income bars for the University of Minnesota and representative public and private colleges in Minnesota. For families with an income of $75,000 or less, no public or private college or university in the state has a lower net price for resident undergraduates than the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. That $75,000 figure represents 130% of Minnesota's median household income of about $57,000. That's important for you to know about the University of Minnesota. As the state invests in keeping our students' tuition increases to zero, we will keep our end of the bargain. We will reduce administrative costs, and we will manage risk responsibly and nimbly. And we will once more tighten our belts administratively. As part of our budget proposal, we will redirect $28 million of our state appropriation, or 5%, in keeping with Governor Dayton's direction to all of our state agencies.
So, President Kaler, on this slide, that $28 million, the 5%, you're saying is going to be put toward tuition. Is that where you intend to go? We don't know. Yes, go ahead, President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, we will move those dollars into our mission and mission support activities and move them out of administrative overhead.
All right.
We're also prepared to hit performance targets. In 2011, the legislature asked us to achieve 3 of 5 performance measurements to prove our accountability. We achieved all 5 of the goals. In this request, we're proposing our own targets, and if we hit 3 of them, we would free up $11.5 million in appropriations. Those measures are increasing our financial aid generated by philanthropy, awarding at least 15,000 degrees on our campuses, increasing our 4-year and 6-year graduation rates on the Twin Cities campus, maintaining our research and development expenditures, and given the sequester, that's not a slam dunk, and increasing our patent disclosures from our vibrant Office of Technology Commercialization. Fiscal year 12, we had a record 321 disclosures, 71 more than in 2011.
President Kaler, do you have, because a lot of your funding is federal, do you have an idea what the sequester is doing to you at this point?
Our estimate is somewhere in the neighborhood of a $50 million hit should the full sequestration damage be felt over years going forward.
President Kaler, how much of that would fall, for instance, in 2013, 2014? Do you have a handle on that?
Mr. Chair, it's... Well, let me use the federal fiscal years. So the current fiscal year will be impacted by the reduction in grants awarded by the NSF and NIH and other federal agencies. That will likely hit in the summer, but it will take a full fiscal year for the full damage to arrive, should it not be corrected.
President Kaler, does that ripple through all your specials? The specials tend to be where you generate private and federal dollars, probably.
Mr. Chair, the numbers I'm referring to are our grant and contract activity from federal research agencies. So they are research activities proposed by faculty, peer-reviewed, and awarded to faculty at the university.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, I have a governance question. This accountability and performance slide raises it, as does the tuition freeze slide. In your opinion, to what extent can legislative appropriations require certain actions at the university, and at what point does that begin to threaten the university's independence?
President Kaler.
Representative Winkler, Chair Pulaski, that is an excellent question, and you are a lawyer and I am not, so I'm going to defer. Certainly, the element of constitutional autonomy is critically important to the university, and I am certain the regents will not step back from it. On the other hand, I think it's fair for the public to ask us to be accountable. So I think the bright line there is clear around autonomy. This is our proposal.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair and President Kaler, you're actually much better suited to answer the question than I am. I don't think it's primarily a legal question. I think it has to be a question of good policy. I can imagine that Representative Gruenhagen might like to require the university to do certain things that I wouldn't want them to do, and we would not want the legislature to start to micromanage the university's affairs and threaten academic freedom and all the rest of those important things. At the same time, if we are investing in a public institution, it seems to me that we are in a position to decide what kinds of things we'd like to buy, including a frozen or lower tuition. It's not a legal question, but there's some middle ground somewhere, and I guess maybe there is nothing other than kind of gray area, and we just sort of work through without any clear guidance on what is an acceptable area for this kind of appropriation leverage and what isn't.
President Kaler.
Representative Winkler, Chair Pulaski, I think this is a robust conversation, and I'd be delighted to continue it, but Vice President Fitzenreiter points out to me that the Constitution invests in the Board of Regents the constitutional authority to set tuition. You, as a legislature, can appropriate money to the university or not.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, President Kaler, but as I remember, the tuition freeze was something that the university brought to the legislature.
That's right.
Representative Kaler.
Sorry. Chair Pulaski, Representative Winkler, that's right. That's my proposal, that I will administratively, I will administratively propose a tuition freeze to the Board of Regents. The Board of Regents, I believe, will agree with me, but they do not have a legal right to do that. It is their right to set the tuition, or legal obligation to do so. It's their right to set the tuition.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just, you don't need to respond to this, but it seems to me that if we are appropriating public funds, we could set conditions, whether those apply to the University of Minnesota, Minsky, or any private nonprofit, that we will not support with state tax dollars any institution that raises tuition beyond a certain percentage. I mean, I just don't know how we can't get into this some middle ground somewhere, because I don't think there is a clear line of demarcation. And certainly the state invests, the public invests enough money in these institutions to have some public good be the requirement for that investment.
President Kaler.
Well, Representative Winkler and Chair Pulaski, I think we are accountable for those. We deliver to you a substantial accountability report annually. I think the public sees where those dollars go, and you as their representatives make a decision on whether or not to give us some more.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your presentation. I'm sorry I had to step out for a little bit. I had a constituent and a couple other things. But one of the things I try to do as a representative is when I get emails from a certain what I consider to be credible individuals to be a vehicle for voicing their thoughts in terms of consideration. And I can't find it right now, but one of the emails I got today, and I can't if it was a retired faculty or a faculty member, and they just brought the suggestion that maybe the university should look at pulling back on the first 2 years of college education and concentrate on the third and fourth and the advanced degrees and the research, and allow the first 2 years to be completed, coordinate with other colleges where it's a little bit more cost effective for students to complete those first 2 years. I don't know if it has merit or not, but I just thought I'd throw it out as I got this suggestion through the from a constituent.
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, people do make that kind of suggestion. It is not a direction that I would like the university to go. There is substantial value in being able to complete a four-year degree at a single institution. There are pedagogical reasons, particularly in some of the technical fields, where courses build upon themselves in a very integrated way, and so being able to take that full course of study at the university is good. But on the other side of the proverbial coin, certainly students are free to do that now. We have over 3,000 students transfer to the U annually, a large majority of them at the end of a two-year period of study at a Minsky school. So that option exists now, certainly.
Mr. Chair. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, just one other follow-up comment. I don't want to micromanage the university either, but I think a broad goal of keeping tuition within a reasonable increase or level and tying some money, access to money, to that goal. Maybe that is micromanaging, but if it's a broad goal that gives you lots of flexibility on how to meet that goal in order to access additional funds, I just think it's an incentive to be as efficient as possible and gives you leverage with your faculty and staff in order to make the changes that you need. The reason I say that is, I've been in a school district that had to go from SOD to a positive fund balance without a tax increase. And all I could keep thinking of the superintendent who made a lot of these decisions was, I sure am glad you got a thick skin, okay? Because I know making decisions that change the structure, that infringe on people's territory in education, is not a popular thing to do. So I applaud you for what you have done. I do think that if you're to continue down that path, if we can help you in any way in terms of giving you some leverage with making those changes, you know, that's what I'm interested in at least. So thank you.
President Kaler, we're almost out of time, so we're going to ask you to come back on Wednesday. There are still a lot of things that we need to take a look at here, and one of them would be the difference between your budget proposal and what the governor has in his budget request, and then what would happen if we significantly drop below the governor, at if we went to 40 instead of 80 or whatever numbers you choose to pick, or zero. And I think zero might be an interesting number. If you did not get any new money from the legislature, then what would be the options before the university for tuition increases and other decision-making, so that we would have those options when we put the finance bill together. So thank you for today, and hoping we can get you back on Wednesday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee.
Representative Dorholt, you have a motion. And members, please put your binders with your name on them in your folder. Representative Dorholt.
And Mr. Chair, I move the minutes of March 6th be approved.
Representative Dorholt moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And again, members, please keep everything handy for Wednesday. We want to pick up exactly where the president left off. Meeting is adjourned.